Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So I want you to imagine, if you will, a biological villain.
Oh, we have a few of those.
Right, but I mean, a protein so notorious for destroying the human brain that just hearing its name, you know, it's basically synonymous with neurodegeneration, with dementia.
Ah, I know exactly which one you're talking about.
Yeah, we're talking about the kind of molecule that, when it misfolds and just goes completely rogue, it leaves this trail of absolute devastation in its wake. It suffocates neurons, it wipes out memories.
It's a heavy topic.
It is. But what if we've completely misunderstood its day job? Like, what actually happens when you take this villain protein and entirely erase it from a perfectly healthy brain?
That is the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Right. Because how could taking away a protein intricately linked to Alzheimer's disease suddenly give our cells' power plants the ability to merge together, work in absolute overdrive, and survive extreme heat and toxic stress?
It sounds like science fiction, honestly.
It really does. It's a bit like discovering that the city's most infamous destructive vandal is actually the secret, highly conservative manager of the entire power grid.
I love that analogy. And it is, I mean, it's a phenomenal paradox. We are so conditioned to view certain biological molecules purely through the lens of pathology.
Exactly, just looking at what they do when they break.
Right. But biology doesn't really evolve molecules just to cause disease. That's not how it works. These structures almost always have a crucial balancing role in a healthy functioning system.
We just ignore them until they break.
Exactly. It's just a role that we tend to completely ignore until things go disastrously wrong and a disease actually manifests.
Well, today we celebrate the work of an international research team, including scientists from the National and Kapodistrian University of Athens in Greece and the University of Minho in Portugal, who have advanced our understanding of mitochondrial dynamics.
And, you know, that kind of global collaborative effort is precisely what is required to solve this specific type of biological mystery.
Because it's not a small mystery.
Not at all. For decades, the global research community has been heavily funded and intensely focused on what this protein does when it breaks down.
Right, the disease state.
Yeah, we almost entirely neglected its baseline life. But this team, they set out to understand the normal physiological role of the protein known as tau.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because if you follow medical science, or honestly, even if you just read the science section of a major newspaper every now and then, you know tau.
It's definitely one of the famous ones.
Yeah. It is the infamous target in Alzheimer's and the whole family of devastating diseases that we group together under the umbrella of tauopathies.
Right.
And the standard model we always hear about is that tau normally functions to stabilize microtubules,
right,
which are basically the structural skeleton and the internal transport highways of a cell.
That's the textbook definition, yeah.
But when tau gets modified incorrectly, specifically when it gets tagged with too many phosphate groups in this process called hyperphosphorylation.
Which is a mouthful.
It really is.
Yeah.
But when that happens, it changes shape. It detaches from the highways and clumps together into neurofibrillary tangles.
The hallmark of Alzheimer's.
Exactly.
Right.
It ruins the cellular transport system, it impairs mitochondrial function, and severely blocks mitophagy, which, for those who might not know, is the necessary process of breaking down and recycling old, damaged power plants in the cell.
Right, the trash cleanup. And that is the established understanding of pathological tau. And it's completely accurate for the disease state.
But there's a but here.
Of a very big but. The researchers recognized a massive gap in that narrative. We know that mutant or hyperphosphorylated or excessively aggregated tau destroys mitochondria.
Yeah.
However, if you look at wild type tau, so the normal healthy version of the protein in a completely healthy brain,
okay,
a significant portion of it is actually found physically localized at the outer mitochondrial membrane.
Wait, really? It's just hanging out on the mitochondria?
Exactly. And that localization naturally begs the question, you know, what is it actively doing there under normal, comfortable physiological conditions?
Right. It isn't just loitering around waiting for a chance to become toxic decades later.
Exactly. It has to have a day job.
And that leads to what I think is the most logical driving question of this entire deep dive.
Let's hear it.
If we know this protein acts like a wrecking ball when it breaks, why hasn't the field spent more time just looking at what happens when it's entirely missing in a healthy brain?
It seems obvious in retrospect, right?
Right. You have to pull it out of the system completely and see how the cell compensates.
Precisely. And to figure out what normal tau does at that outer mitochondrial membrane, the researchers utilized two highly complementary models.
Okay, what did they use?
First, they looked at genetically engineered mice that entirely lack the MAPT gene.
So these mice produce absolutely no tau protein whatsoever.
Exactly, total knockout. Second, they utilized the nematode Canerhabditis elegans.
The famous C. elegans worm.
That's the one. And they engineered it to lack a specific gene called PTL1.
Right, and for context, if you aren't familiar with nematode genetics, PTL1 is the microscopic worm's evolutionary equivalent of mammalian tau.
Yes, the homologue.
The structures of the proteins, particularly the domains that bind to those microtubule highways we talked about, they are highly conserved across millions of years of evolution.
And that strategy, you know, using both a mammal and a nematode is absolutely critical for a study like this.
Because it proves it's not just a fluke.
Exactly. If you observe a metabolic shift in just a knockout mouse, you might simply be looking at a quirk of mammalian biology or a specific compensatory mechanism in rodents.
Right, like maybe mice just have a weird workaround.
Yeah, and if you see it just in a worm, it might be an invertebrate-specific phenomenon.
Makes sense.
But when you completely remove a protein in a complex mammal, and you remove its evolutionary homologue in a microscopic worm,
you see the exact same thing.
And you witness the exact same fundamental shift in cellular physiology. You haven't found a quirk. You have uncovered a deeply conserved fundamental rule of biological regulation.
I mean, that is just so cool. And the technology they use to actually visualize and measure this regulation is phenomenal.
Oh, the tech is amazing.
Right. To measure bioenergetics, they used high-resolution respirometry, specifically a platform called the Seahorse XF Analyzer.
A staple in modern metabolic labs.
Yeah. And for those who haven't seen one of these in a lab, it essentially lets scientists watch live mitochondria breathe in real time.
It's literally tracking their oxygen use.
Exactly. It uses these specialized sensor cartridges that lower into microplates containing the cells, and it creates a tiny temporary seal to measure the incredibly slight drops in oxygen concentration as the mitochondria consume it.
And they paired that functional data with some really stunning visual data too.
Yes. Transmission electron microscopy, or TEM, alongside advanced fluorescent tagging.
TEM is incredible for structural detail.
It really is. It shoots a beam of electrons through ultra-thin slices of tissue, allowing researchers to literally look at the physical, ultra-structural shape of the mitochondria inside living neurons.
So they have the function and the structure.
Right. We essentially took the steering wheel out of a mouse and a microscopic worm to see exactly how the engine would react both functionally and physically.
So let's look at that functional reaction first. The bioenergetics captured by the Seahorse XF data.
What did the engine do?
Well, when they analyzed the mitochondria from the brains of the tau knockout mice and the neurons of the PTL1 knockout worms, the data showed these mitochondria were breathing significantly harder.
Like revving the engine.
Exactly. They demonstrated a higher basal oxygen consumption rate and a much higher stimulated rate. Consequently, they were producing significantly more cellular energy, more ATP.
Okay, I do want to push back on one specific metric in that assay, though.
Oh.
Yeah, because looking at the supplementary data, it mentions that without tau, these mitochondria exhibited an increased proton leak.
Ah, yes, the proton leak.
Now, if we think about the electron transport chain, a leak sounds like a compromised membrane, right? Like a cracked pipe in a basement just letting pressure escape.
That is the natural assumption, yes.
So how does a leak translate to a sign of enhanced healthy metabolic activity rather than structural damage?
You are totally right that in a failing pathological system, a high proton leak often indicates severe membrane damage. It usually means impending cell death.
Okay, so why is it good here?
Context changes the meaning of the metric. In this specific physiological state, the leak isn't a sign of a compromised membrane. It's a byproduct of a massive overall elevation in respiratory activity.
So it's just from running too hot.
Exactly. The biological engine is running so hot and pushing electrons so fast that uncoupling occurs. It's a controlled release of protons back across the membrane.
Oh, like a pressure release valve.
Yes, exactly. This actually prevents the membrane potential from getting dangerously high, which would stall the engine entirely. Because the basal respiration is elevated and the overall energy production is vastly up, this specific leak is an indicator of a highly active metabolic rate. It is a bioenergetic overdrive, perfectly balanced, rather than a catastrophic failure.
Okay, that makes so much sense. The functional data is impressive, but honestly, the visual data from the electron microscopy is what really grabbed my attention.
The images are striking.
They really are. They didn't just measure the oxygen consumption, they looked at the physical architecture of these supercharged power plants. And without tau, the mitochondria undergo a radical physical transformation.
It's a completely different landscape.
Yeah. Because in a typical neuron, mitochondria often look like little isolated beings, you know, like fragmented, distinct, and separate from one another.
Right, individual units.
But without tau present at the membrane, they stop being fragmented. They stretch out, they elongate, and connect into this massive, highly intertwined network.
It's a huge shift in dynamics.
I couldn't stop thinking about Voltron or Megazord, right, where you have these individual separate units that suddenly physically link up to form a giant supergrid.
That's actually a really great way to visualize it.
And they do this to share lipid membranes, exchange mitochondrial DNA, and vastly boost their collective efficiency, right?
Right. And the structural data clearly supports that massive networking effect. The researchers quantified this using a metric called the form factor, which essentially measures elongation and branching.
Okay, and what did that show?
Without tau, there was a massive, statistically significant increase in mitochondria with a form factor greater than 1.5.
So, way more elongated.
Way more. And the mechanisms driving this physical change were clearly identifiable. You see, mitochondrial dynamics are controlled by a constant tug of war between proteins that split them apart.
Fission.
Right, fission. And proteins that merge them together, fusion.
Okay.
In the tau knockout models, the protein responsible for splitting mitochondria apart, known as DRP1, decreased significantly at the outer membrane.
So less splitting.
Exactly. Simultaneously, the core proteins responsible for merging them together, mitofusin 1 and 2, increased.
Wow.
The entire physical architecture of the cellular energy grid shifted definitively away from fission and into a robust profusion state.
Which is an incredible adaptation.
Yeah.
But as we know with cellular biology, there's never a free lunch.
There really isn't.
A supercharged engine burning that much fuel has to produce something on the back end.
Precisely. And this brings us to the trade-off, commonly referred to as the ROS paradox.
Okay, break that down for us.
ROS stands for reactive oxygen species. These are the highly reactive molecules, essentially the metabolic exhaust produced when mitochondria consume oxygen to generate energy.
Right.
Because these fused, highly networked mitochondria are operating in absolute overdrive, they produce a significantly higher volume of this exhaust, specifically in the form of hydrogen peroxide.
Which usually isn't great for a cell.
No, it's not. Under normal, highly comfortable environmental conditions, which for these specific laboratory worms is a mild 20 degrees Celsius.
Like a nice spring day.
Yeah. Under those conditions, this chronically high exhaust level actually acts as a biological stressor. It accelerates their aging process and shortens their overall lifespan.
Oh, wow. So they live shorter lives.
Yes. But if you introduce an antioxidant called NAC to chemically neutralize and clear that exhaust, their lifespan perfectly reverts back to normal.
So running a super engine in normal, everyday traffic just burns out the parts faster.
That's a perfect way to put it.
But then the researchers changed the environment and the results completely flipped.
I did.
When they took these exact same tau-deficient worms and subjected them to intense, highly lethal stress, like increasing the ambient temperature to a mild heat stress of 25 degrees.
Or subjecting them to an acute heat shock at 37 degrees.
Right. Or even dosing their environment with a potent mitochondrial toxin called antimycin A. Under all those conditions, the worms without tau survived significantly better than the normal, healthy control worms.
It's wild. They were incredibly resilient to the toxicity.
They really were. The researchers even measured physical neurodegeneration by counting axonal blebs.
Which is a great term.
It sounds gross, but yeah. They're essentially microscopic stress blisters that form on nerve fibers when a neuron is dying. And the worms without tau had significantly fewer blebs.
They were actively protected.
Yeah, so the metabolic exhaust they were producing in overdrive was actually acting like a constant cellular fire drill, keeping the cell on high alert so it could survive a massive real-world crisis.
The biological term for that mechanism is mitohormesis.
Mitohormesis.
Yes. a low persistent dose of a stressor in this case, the slightly elevated hydrogen peroxide acting as a signaling molecule triggers vast adaptive protective pathways.
So the exhaust is the signal.
Exactly. The ROS molecules physically oxidize specific sensor proteins, which then travel into the nucleus to turn on a whole suite of stress defense genes.
Ah, so the chronic fire drill literally builds more molecular fire extinguishers.
Beautifully said. However, the researchers still needed to prove causality.
Right, they had to be sure.
They had to demonstrate that the physical elongation and networking the fusion was the mandatory mechanism driving this stress resistance, rather than just a coincidental byproduct of lacking tau.
And to find that definitive proof, they engineered a very specific double mutant worm.
I did.
They took the worms that already lacked PTL1, the tau equivalents, and then they additionally knocked out a gene called FZO1.
Yes.
Now, FZO1 is the worm's evolutionary version of the mitofusin protein. It is the literal mechanical machinery required to merge two mitochondria together.
Right.
Without FZO1, the mitochondria physically cannot fuse, no matter what signals they receive.
So by breaking the fusion machinery, they isolated the variable.
When what happened?
The results were definitive. Losing FZO1 completely erased every single biological superpower associated with lacking tau.
Wow, just gone.
Instantly. The enhanced motility, the profound stress resilience, the survival against acute heat shock and mitochondrial toxins, all of it vanished.
So they were just like normal worms again.
Worse, they died from stress just like the controls. The mitochondria reverted to their fragmented, isolated state.
That's incredible.
Furthermore, when they took completely normal worms and simply overexpressed FZO1, so artificially forcing the mitochondria to fuse together without touching the tau equivalent at all.
Let me guess, it worked.
It perfectly copied the profound benefits of the tau knockout.
That is just brilliant experimental design.
It really is. This elegant genetic manipulation proved definitively that mitochondrial fusion is the mandatory central mechanism unlocking these abilities.
When we step back and synthesize all of this data, I mean, it completely redefines our baseline understanding of the protein.
It changes everything.
The wild-type tau isn't just a structural scaffold for internal cellular highways. It is actively functioning as a physiological brake on mitochondrial fusion.
It intentionally restrains the power grid.
Right. It keeps the mitochondria from constantly fusing and running in a state of overdrive because, as we saw with the lifespan data, running in overdrive all the time burns the cell out in a calm, stress-free environment.
Exactly. Tau is there to maintain a very specific metabolic baseline.
It forces us to ask some pretty deep questions about clinical interventions, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The field of neurodegeneration has spent decades trying to eliminate toxic tau tangles.
Right.
Currently, there are highly advanced therapies in clinical trials, such as antisense oligonucleotides, that are fundamentally designed to lower the overall amount of tau being produced in the brains of Alzheimer's patients.
And for those who might not be familiar with the exact mechanism, antisense oligonucleotides don't just clear away the existing clumps, right?
No, they act way upstream.
Right. They are custom-designed synthetic strands of genetic code that physically bind to the messenger RNA, which is the molecular blueprint for tau.
Correct.
And by intercepting that blueprint, they signal the cell to destroy it before the tau protein can even be manufactured by the cellular factories.
That's exactly how they work.
So the original goal of these trials was simply to stop the production of the raw material that eventually forms the toxic tangles.
But the findings from this deep dive suggest those advanced therapies might be doing something exponentially more profound to the surviving neurons.
Because they're removing the normal tau too.
Exactly. By fundamentally lowering the total amount of tau, including the wild-type protein hanging out at the mitochondria, these drugs might not just be preventing a toxic clump.
They're changing the baseline.
They might actively be taking the brakes off mitochondria. They might be allowing the patient's struggling neuronal power plants to aggressively fuse, share vital lipid resources, repair their damaged DNA, and generate that mitohormetic stress response.
The fire drill.
Yes. The response necessary to survive the intensely toxic cellular environment of a neurodegenerative disease. It shifts the mechanism of these drugs from merely clearing debris to actively boosting cellular resilience.
Which offers a massive new dimension of hope for those therapies. I mean, that's huge.
It is huge.
But I imagine we still have to be incredibly careful about just severing the brake lines completely in a human brain.
Oh, absolutely. And the paper is very careful to highlight that limitation. Biology demands balance.
Right. The 20-degree worm lifespan.
Exactly. Perpetual metabolic activation and constantly elevated ROS levels are simply not viable for long-term neuronal health. Over decades, running the mitochondrial engine at the red line will cause irreversible oxidative wear and tear on the cell.
So we can't just floor it forever.
No. The next major frontier for this specific research will be investigating how we can precisely tune this fusion machinery.
Like an anti-lock braking system.
That's a good way to look at it. Can we find a pharmacological way to gently tap the brake pedal, allowing transient bursts of protective mitochondrial fusion during periods of acute cellular stress, without cutting the brake line entirely?
We need to grant these failing cells the necessary stress resilience without inadvertently burning them out prematurely.
Precisely. It fundamentally forces us to rethink our entire categorization of these molecules.
It really does.
Yeah.
To summarize the core findings here, wild-type tau isn't merely a skeleton protein waiting for a chance to misfold and cause disease.
Far from it.
It actively and constantly regulates our cellular power plants, keeping a highly specific, tight leash on mitochondrial fusion.
Right.
And removing tau completely removes this leash, rapidly shifting neurons into a highly fused, hyperactive metabolic state that leverages controlled oxidative stress to build an incredible protective resilience against extreme environmental and toxic conditions.
It proves that context is absolutely everything. What we call a disease protein is often just a vital regulator that we only happen to study when the system is collapsing.
Which leaves you with this specific thought to explore on your own. If removing the central protein responsible for Alzheimer's disease actually triggers a latent biological superpower against severe stress, what other so-called villain proteins in our bodies are secretly just waiting for us to figure out how to harness their actual day jobs?
It's a fascinating question.
What does this mean for the entire future of how we view and ultimately treat neurodegeneration as a whole?
I think we're just scratching the surface.
I think you're right. This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
True.